Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, January 14th, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thanks for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 22 the hour. And we got another great show for you today that's going to include, why is U.S. healthcare ranked last amongst all industrialized countries in the world?
And why Congress should not expand medical research?
Why do cancer research studies downplay chemotherapy side effects?
And can drinking soft drinks lead to depression?
And can H. pylori protect against stroke and lung cancer?
It's not new that the United States is ranked 37th in the world in healthcare, but it's really a tragedy that a new report finds that we die sooner and have higher rates of disease and injury than the top 16 high-income countries in the world, like Japan and Australia, Canada, and Western Europe. This is from birth to age 76. This is literally sick. How can this be?
Yeah, really, this is weird. We said we spend all this money, we've got all this technology, and when you look at what we do in healthcare, it's unbelievable for people who can afford it.
It's really hard to believe these statistics.
I know. Well, I just had a friend who was in the hospital. He just turned 70, and he had a little bout of atrial fibrillation, caught very early. First thing they do is a nice 24-hour Holter monitor. They capture it. They see there's a problem. They discuss with them the three options that they have for treatment. And then they say, which would you like to do? And he elects to have what's known as an ablation, where they take the area of the heart where the nerve is that's causing all these fast beats to occur, and they ablate it.
What's ablate mean?
To destroy the tissue so that it can't do that. It's an easy thing. It's like going in there and cauterizing some of the nerves in the heart.
Uh-huh.
They make a little incision in the wrist and in the groin. They put up some catheters. They got movie cameras that look at it. They're looking at all the technology that can be done. They measure the electrical activity of different places in the heart. They decide where they're going to put this ablation, and they do it many times in different places. And he's in a place that looks like Star Trek medicine. Wow. What could you ask for that's more technical? He'll probably never have a problem with atrial fibrillation again. You're talking about the best of the best in
technology. I thought you were going to say something bad happened.
No, it was wonderful. Okay. I'm saying how good American medicine is. It's the very best. How could it be ranked 37th? How could it be ranked 16 out of 16 in all the industrialized countries in the world? What are we doing wrong?
So what are we doing wrong?
Well, we're more interested in money than we are in anything else. We're spending $8,000 now per person per year. You would think for $8,000 per person per year in this country, which comes to $2.8 trillion a year, that we got to have a healthcare system that would deliver the kind of healthcare that my friend had to everybody. You look at a country like Oman, little country like Oman, they spend $500 a year per person per healthcare, and they're ranked in the top 10 in the world. Why is that? They don't have this technology. They don't have all the good stuff we have. How can that happen? Because it's about disparities. Who gets the health care? You're looking at people who are in Congress or the president or people who have insurance programs that are the Cadillac programs. They're doing fine. They get the best care in the world. Then you go to Medicaid or you go to Medi-Cal, and now you got a system where you have to wait. You may not get the services you want depending on where you live, and you won't get the best doctors. It's about that simple.
Well, I have a friend that just had surgery on her shoulder.
Yes, that's why I said depends on where it is.
And she has Medi-Cal, uh-huh. Or Medicare.
Medicare
and Medi-Cal.
Medi-Cal, that's right.
And she's in one of the major hospitals,
uh-huh.
And she's going to be going to rehab, and uh-huh. They've got it all lined up for when she goes home, that the physical therapist, the occupational therapist, uh-huh. They're going to bring her food. They're
yes.
Going to even do some house cleaning for
right.
Her. She's going to have a nurse. I mean, it's wonderful.
So you're looking
but
at
she knew how to work the system,
there
I guess.
There you go. So there are some people who know how to get the best out of the system. But you can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. That's what it boils down to. If you don't have the funds, you can't spend the money. And if you don't spend the money, you're not going to provide that kind of service.
So let's talk about some of the areas where we're failing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like one of them says infant mortality and low birth weight.
Well, infant mortality is high. Why? A lot of women are smoking. A lot of women are using alcohol. They're on drugs. And why are they doing that? It's because they're growing up in areas that are difficult because there's a lot of crime. There's not as much opportunity. They don't get educated. They're not turning out to be the rocket scientists of tomorrow. And they live in places like the Iron Triangle in Richmond, California, where, let me tell you, murders and all kinds of things are going on that are not the best place to grow up.
And drug deaths.
Sure. So the opportunities there are really low. So these women, they're not going to have the best health care because they aren't going to know what to do or decide that that's what they are going to do. And that's why the babies have low birth weight. That's no surprise.
So it's interesting compared to the rest of the world that the U.S. is near the bottom in infant mortality and low birth weight, and also in injuries and homicides.
Well, look at cities like Oakland, California, or like Atlanta in Georgia. There are more deaths there than there are in the Iraq War.
Yeah.
There's people, I mean, it's like mayhem. We have a bigger war in this country than we have in Afghanistan.
Well, other things added to this list are teenage pregnancies and sexually transmitted infections.
Yeah, that all goes with the same thing. If you have lack of education and people are frustrated, they're not getting the emotional satisfaction that they need, one of the things that people turn to is sex. And if it's unprotected sex, what would you expect?
And then right along with that is the prevalence of HIV and AIDS.
Absolutely. I mean, look at the epidemic of that. I mean, it's not what it was cracked up to be, for sure. That's another long story about HIV and AIDS. Even though we've come a long way in our treatment and we're definitely saving some lives, at the beginning it wasn't that way. And on another show, we'll talk about the dissident people who are not believing that HIV causes AIDS and people who think that it does. And they've got all these treatments for it that are controversial.
For years, we've been talking about how there's an obesity epidemic and a diabetes epidemic in the United States. And it just seems to continue on. We keep talking about it, trying to help people to get through that. But so many times I think, oh, some of it's emotional, I guess, you know, with the eating. And it is tough to lose weight. It's not easy. That's why they have all these ads about it on television.
Well, why are we driven to eat like we are? We eat food that's not healthy for us. Our body's in an inflamed state because we have a lot of exposures to toxic things in the environment, plus all the stress we're in. We don't get enough sleep. And when all those things happen, then our hormones are affected by it when we're inflamed. So our insulin becomes resistant, our leptin becomes resistant, and those are the hormones that have a big effect on how much we eat because it affects our appetite center in the brain.
Well, another thing is it's like this article says that we're failing in heart disease too. And look at all the advances that have been made.
Sure, look at the story of my friend.
And heart surgeries and open heart surgeries and all that.
Well, we shouldn't need them because if we live a healthy lifestyle, we're not going to get sick as often. We clean up the environment. We eat a decent diet that gives us the nutrients that we need to be able to have our bodies function optimally. We get enough rest. We're not all stressed out. Chances are that what's going to make us sick? Because those are the things that lead to all the problems that we're seeing in this epidemic of chronic diseases for which we don't have an answer.
And one of them includes chronic lung disease.
Sure.
And disability.
Well, look at people who are smoking and people who are living in cities where the air is bad and there's a lot of pollution. Again, something that industrialized countries have more of, but if you don't have an environmental system that's cleaning up the air and cleaning up the water and the soil and the food, what would you expect would happen? Why do you think we're sick?
Well, I've noticed that whenever we've traveled, it seems like that there's more smoking in other countries than there is here.
There's a lot more smoking in Europe and in other third world countries for sure. And I think that, too, is a reflection of how much stress there is in younger countries that don't have as much economic wealth, because there is a relationship between wealth and what you can provide in the way of services for people and education that you can provide. The question is when is this country going to have the maturity to be able to spend those dollars the best way so that we don't have these kinds of problems to deal with?
So here the U.S. spends more on health care than any other nation, and yet our youth are dying younger, and they have more illnesses and injuries than in other countries. And this includes our babies and our kids and our teens. Mm-hmm. Now, there's nothing worse from what everybody says than losing a child.
Oh, for sure.
And to think that our youth die younger and have more illnesses and injuries than in all these other countries is just appalling.
Well, it's telling you what our values are like.
Why are we slipping behind other countries?
Okay. It's what our values are. We're the first generation that's going to have children that don't live as long as we did, as we will, because they're getting all these problems that are related to why we don't take care of ourselves.
It's a faster lifestyle, so everybody's looking for shortcuts.
Well, that's part of it, but it's also competitive and adversarial. I mean, it's we're out for ourselves. We want to make a fortune. We want to have as much money as we can, as much power as we can. And if we have all that, we think we're successful. And let me tell you, I take care of a lot of people that are millionaires, and those people are no happier, okay, than a lot of other people who have less money.
Okay, now here's another fact that came up that's pretty interesting. Over 75 years of age, Americans live longer.
Yeah.
They have less strokes, they have less cancer, high blood pressure, less cholesterol problems, and less smoking.
Yeah.
So how do you explain this besides the less smoking?
Well, I think that maybe it's survival of the fittest. I mean, everybody drops off before that. The people that are left that are 75 and older,
that's why
are the
they're
real
still
tough
there.
Guys. Yeah, they're the because ones that have good genes and are, you know, maybe they're the ones that have taken care of themselves too. Because, I mean, how many people die of violence and of accidents and of things that have to do with diseases that are related to lifestyle? A lot. And those people that are living, if they get to 75, that's probably self-selecting out those people that are the best. So there's a lot going on there.
So do you think that there's been any improvement since the World Health Organization ranked us 37th in the world?
Not really. Relatively, I don't see it, because what we have is a system that's based on economics. I mean, why do we spend more than anybody else? Because healthcare has become a business. And businesses' purpose is to make money. And we're doing that. We're keeping the economy going. And that's important. That's a big deal. But it's not enough to keep the economy going. That doesn't necessarily make you healthy.
And some of what Western medicine does is actually killing a lot of people.
Well, there are about 1 million people that die at the hands of the Western medical system in one way or another. There are 400,000 deaths from medications, many of which are the expected side effects of medications. But that also includes the misuse of them, the failure to prescribe them right or to make errors. It's a big number, which tells us that it's a dangerous system, and it's not the safest thing to do to be able to keep people functioning.
And complications. I know somebody else that just had open heart surgery, and she had a stroke.
Yeah, well, it happens. You have the good technology. You better do it well. But the big problem is we look for a way to not have to take care of ourselves, because we have been convinced, brainwashed, by direct-to-consumer ads, by the medical profession, by the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry and the CDC and and all these other organizations, that if we don't take care of ourselves, that they'll take care of us because they've got the technology to do it. It's like the Greyhound bus company that says, hey, just leave the driving to us and we'll get you there.
So just wait and get sick and think you're going to be taken care of.
Yeah, well, that's what we believe. So, I mean, look at any direct-to-consumer ad. You've got to be almost a moron to listen to a direct-to-consumer ad and listen to all the things they tell you that can go wrong and say, here, take this antidepressant or this antipsychotic medicine.
It's almost like a setup for a comedy routine.
It is a tremendous comedy.
Only it's not funny.
It's a not funny comedy. It's a sick, sad, tragedy comedy. It's a Shakespearean story. And we bought into it.
It's like the drama mask where one half of it's laughing and the other half is sad.
Exactly. I mean, you hear somebody saying it can cause a heart attack and a stroke. It can give you impotence. It can cause a problem with diabetes. But don't worry because it'll make you feel a little less depressed. Hello. I mean, is that really worth it? And what the thinking is, and this is not just the thinking of patients, but unfortunately of doctors too, because we're trained that way. It's not our fault. It's not the patient's fault either. We don't think about, what can I do? It's not like JFK said so many years ago, it's not what my country can do for me, but what can I do for it? Same thing applies to the body. What can I do for my body, myself, rather than what do I have to depend on from somebody else to do it for me? We've got to take that kind of responsibility. And if we take that responsibility, we're not going to have all the problems that we do. We're not going to need all the medications with all those terrible side effects. And it doesn't mean that medicine is the most unbelievable science in the world. It absolutely is brilliant stuff, but it's overdone. It's the first cab off the rank, as the Aussies would say. It's not the well-thought-out choice to make. It shouldn't be the first thing we should do. Because it's dangerous, it should be the last thing we do.
Well, too, many times we talk about medical freedom and how we don't have medical freedom.
That's part of it.
And there's so much pressure when you do get sick to do it the Western way. Mm-hmm. And we've talked on other fast tracks and radio shows about things like, for example, when you get cancer and what happens with the treatments and how sick it can make you. And many times it doesn't even prolong your life much.
Well, yeah, why would you buy into that?
But
we're going to talk about that
later.
But
knowing, too, that there are other ways to do it and go about it. So anyway, it appears that just being an American is a health disadvantage.
Well, that's what this says.
We eat more calories. We have more injuries. We have, interestingly enough, less education and income equality. And usually this is what we criticize about third world countries when we have a lot of this going on right at home.
Well, we could do something about it because we have the funds, but we don't even have the foresight to try and get our homeless off the streets. For some reason, that doesn't seem to be important. I mean, those people who are a conglomerate of people who have mental illnesses for lots of reasons we should be paying attention to that.
Well, our values are what's sick. And that's what's making us sick.
That's correct. We bought into a system that's more about economics than it is about service. It's more about narcissism than it is about community. It's not about what you can give. It's about what you can take. And as long as we have that system, we are absolutely handcuffed. We cannot evolve to the next higher level of consciousness that actually makes life pleasant.
So what this is about, it's about prevention and taking responsibility for your own health, taking care of yourself and your loved ones.
Yes, but
and not waiting to get sick.
It's about listening to people and caring about them. It's about supporting them when they've got problems. It's about trying to make them better.
And if you want to have a baby, start eating healthy and being healthy before you get pregnant.
There are a lot of things like that, but until the attitude shifts and we're really concerned about community, life is going to be exactly like it is today. I have so many people that come into the office, and this is their lifestyle. They're up at 6, they're home at 6. They eat dinner, they watch TV, spend a little time with the kids and wife, and they get up and they do it again 6 days a week. That's the sick syndrome, because you're up at 6, home at 6, and there's not much else to like.
The six.
That's right.
That sounds like a tongue twister.
It is a tongue twister.
The six sheiks, six sheep sick.
You got that one right. So when I see people like that, my heart bleeds because I'm going, what can you do to help those people? Because they're caught in this economic turmoil, and what they're trying to do is save money for their kids to go to college if they're living in our community. Or they're, you know, trying to just get their kids out of the violent places like Oakland and Richmond and Atlanta and New York and a lot of cities have all these problems.
Well, this is where it's also good to have a meaningful purpose in life, and it's not just about watching TV when you come home.
You just said the whole thing. That's what this whole thing is about. That's why Americans are sicker and why Americans are dying sooner. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on great reasons to use fresh basil. And when we come back, we'll be talking about why Congress should not expand medical research. Buy that one. And that's by Dr. Len and Nurse Vicky. Stay tuned.
Basil's been around and used medicinally for over 5,000 years, with hundreds of varieties all over the world with consistent medicinal qualities from one strain to another. And you need to keep in mind that the volatile oils of dried basil are weak, so fresh basil is better, and it's good for cooking and for our healing treatments. And some of the health and medicinal benefits of fresh basil are anti-inflammatory. It's a natural anti-inflammatory, and it combats even bowel inflammation and rheumatoid arthritis and intestinal parasites. And fresh basil leaves and basil oil also have antibacterial properties, and they can disinfect surfaces when and also when applied to wounds, they might eliminate infections. And I was thinking this might be a good thing to try instead of some antibiotic ointments that can promote antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Yeah, it might be a thing to start with, huh?
And basil is very high in antioxidants, especially when it's used in the extract or the oil, and it can protect against free radical damage that's associated with aging and some of the skin ailments. And basil juice can be applied directly to the skin, to the affected area. And it also protects against most forms of cancer, and it's a great health boost for our immune systems. Basil also can be used for respiratory disorders. It's good in cough syrups and as an expectorant. It can relieve mucus and asthma and bronchitis. And even chewing on basil leaves can relieve cold and flu symptoms and allergies, which is a good thing to know about this time of year. And I was thinking, what about pesto? Yum, yum. Because the basil leaves in the blender with olive oil and garlic and a little Parmesan or pecorino cheese and even some pine nuts can be put on pasta and chicken and fish and raviolis and salmon and spaghetti and the red sauce and everything. It's delicious that way. So yummy. What a good way to get in your basil, especially if you've got a cold or the flu or something.
Yeah, or you just want to have something that tastes good.
That's yeah, right. Yeah. And basil can also be helpful in heart disease, and it can reduce cholesterol. It's also good for kidney stones. If you mix the juice of basil leaves with a little honey, and you take it every day for 6 months, it'll expel those kidney stones through the urinary tract. I don't know if you want to wait for 6 months to get them out.
It's a kind of a painful process. I don't think so.
But dry basil leaves, and you can dry them in the sun and then grind them into a powder, and you can make a tooth cleansing powder. Mm. And also, if you mix it with mustard oil, you can make an herbal toothpaste. And both of these methods counter not just bad breath, but they can be used to massage the gums and treat pyorrhea and other dental health problems. And also, chewing a few basil leaves twice a day can cure infections and ulcerations in the mouth. That's a good, handy thing to know about.
Absolutely. Mother Nature is amazing.
And also, it's good for insect bites. You can put the basil juice right on those insect bites to relieve the itching and the swelling. And also, it's good for headaches. You boil the leaves in water, and then you cook it till half the liquid remains, and then you use a couple teaspoons an hour with water to relieve the pain of the swelling of the headache. And last but not least is stress, because it's used as an anti-stress agent. But this is a lot. You're supposed to chew 12 basil leaves twice a day to prevent stress. But
well,
if you eat the pesto,
oh, absolutely.
That's an easy way to do it.
And it really tastes good.
So if you're stressed, eat some pesto.
Well, basil, spices, really things like that should be part of our daily food.
You know, most Americans think that if we don't take care of ourselves by living a healthy lifestyle, that the medical profession will come to the rescue.
Yeah, it will, all right.
And the majority of Americans believe research is the answer, that it's accurate without a conflict of interest and the answer in conquering disease.
Yeah, well, that's
really
what they've convinced us to believe. We've been brainwashed to think that. And, of course, what we should be doing is taking care of ourselves. Now, if we were going to depend on medical research to bail us out of trouble, we're going to wait a long time because a lot of the research that we have simply isn't that good of research.
And you know what's really scary is that the doctors use that and rely on that in taking care of us.
When you're in the ICU and you've got a critical illness and you're wondering if this is the right antibiotic or that's the right drug that's anti-inflammatory or whatever you're doing, it sure as heck should be the right one. But as long as the pharmaceutical industry is doing the bulk of the research, and they do two-thirds of it, they fund two-thirds of it, and they lie the way they do to make their data look like it's different than it actually is, you can't trust it.
So then what's wrong with having Congress do the research?
Well, Congress is going to fund the research, is what they're saying. So this study was done out of a company called America Speaks, and it's a compilation of public opinion polls from Research America. And what they concluded was, is 72% of people thought that the new Congress and the president should take action to expand medical research within the first 100 days, okay, of the 113th Congress. Well, who's that going to really benefit? If you believe Marcia Angel, okay, the Harvard doctor who was the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, and Catherine DeAngelis of the Journal of the American Medical Association, that the research that's coming out of their journals is not to be trusted a lot of the time, who gets the benefit? It's the people who pay for the research, they get it to say what they want it to say, and sell the drugs. And who else benefits besides them? The insurance companies will, because there's bigger stakes in what happens because there's more money. 10% profit out of $100 is $10. 10% profit out of $10 billion is a lot more.
So what's happening is that people are just assuming that the research is accurate.
Well, they think, well, it's highly trusted. It saves lives or at least is supposed to help you. But maybe it doesn't. And I think a lot of the time that's not the best way to go. So do we need more research to make America more have a healthcare system that's better?
Well, particularly if we spend more money to increase the amount of unreliable research.
Well, I mean, we'd obviously be doing that as well. And that's not what the goal should be.
So we need to clean up the research and get rid of the conflicts of interest. Then talk about it.
If we were going to do it, that's what I would recommend too. But I don't recommend that either.
I guess what you probably are going to say what you recommend is starting with prevention.
Yeah, let's do some lifestyle medicine and take care of people that way. I mean, look at what this poll showed. They said 78% of Americans believe it's important for the U.S. to improve healthcare globally through research and innovation. But it's nothing saying anything about taking personal responsibility or about who's really going to benefit from this. This is a great ploy to make business for the companies that are the segments of the medical industry that are going to make more money if there's more research. But it's not necessarily going to make you healthier.
Well, like you said earlier, America's been brainwashed by the medical industry to leave the driving to us.
Yeah, it's the Greyhound bus company again.
Leaving the driving to them.
Well, that's right. Well, did you know that 70% of Americans in this poll said also that the government should encourage science, technology, math, and engineering? Well, okay. I mean, that might be okay, but I wouldn't put that as the first thing to do. I would say it's at the expense of the emotional and spiritual growth of people who are getting an education. We need a balanced education. We need values that are better. We're always talking about that.
Well, what would happen if we cut the effects of funding for medical research?
There'd be less of it. There'd be less bad research. There'd also be less good research. But see, research isn't the answer. If we think that we're going to be bailed out of taking care of ourselves, think again. As long as you eat wrong, don't exercise right, are exposed to toxic exposures, don't get enough sleep, and under too much stress, how the hell are you going to be healthy? Then you're going to be depending on silver bullets or promises for things that are supposed to work that don't work that well. That's why we have so many deaths every year and why 50% of America is suffering from a chronic disease. What does it take to get through the thick skulls of the people?
It's like the Cliff story.
Indeed, which is too long to tell. It's a John Robbins story, and it's about trying to make the medical system revolve around what we already have, not about preventing anything. We need prevention. They also say that 48% believe that the government should invest in health research for military veterans, and because there's not enough. Well, that's a duh. I agree with that too. But how short-sighted do you want to get? Why do we have these problems? It's because we have wars. So what's the answer? No wars. Let's do less in the way of wars. Let's try and put our people who are declaring war have more skin in the game. Let's make sure that the people who are involved, Congress is involved in wars, has their own kids going first.
Yeah.
Okay? Rather than us going first. There are lots of things that we could do that work from the top down better if we respect them.
Just like them having the same healthcare system we do.
That's right. It's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio, and we'll be talking about why do cancer research studies downplay chemotherapy side effects? Stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
We've been talking for some time now about the problems with research studies that are not accurate. And this is very important because doctors depend on study outcomes to treat their patients. And another study came out about these inaccuracies. And this one is on the side effects of breast cancer treatments and how they are downplayed.
It's really sad that we can't just do things objectively. It all gets complicated because we want to do what we can to generate income. We do want to help patients, but it's not the primary thing. And I think doctors generally do want to help their patients, but even they have conflicts of interest, and we've talked about those before. But what Vicki's talking about is an article that was published in the January issue of Annals of Oncology. And in two-thirds of the 164 studies they looked at, they found that they didn't list the serious side effects, whether the chemotherapy was treated or was used or radiation or surgery. And this is really dishonest because what it's doing is it's giving one side of the story.
Well, the investigators want their studies to look positive, so they often go overboard to please their sponsors so that they'll be hired again.
Well, that's exactly what happens. And then we're overtreating people because, let's face it, in somebody who has a stage 4 cancer, the five-year survival rates are about 2%. So how aggressive do you want to get at giving chemotherapies or radiation or surgeries to people that aren't really going to benefit that much? They're going to be spending a lot of money on treatment most of the time. They're going to have lots of side effects, the nausea and vomiting and hair loss and other things that they experience, and even infections and death.
Mouth sores and bleeding. And
It's not a cakewalk to be on chemotherapy or these other treatments.
But one of the things that happens is that doctors are busy people, you know, and they often just skim the articles for the information. And they often only have time to look at the results in the tables and the figures and the abstracts.
Yeah, it's not enough.
And the researchers are eliminating their findings in those summaries.
That's right.
And they do that to get published in the top journals.
Well, that's right.
It seems to me that the journals need to take some responsibility for this and insist that the authors include these statistics and facts in their abstracts.
You would think so. I mean, if you look at a fifth of the studies, they did include serious side effects in the result tables even, which are just places where you have to look at the raw data and figure it out yourself. A third failed to mention it in the abstract or the discussion part of the paper. So they even change sometimes the endpoints of the study. If it came out not showing what they hoped the study would show, they move the goalposts, and they wind up with different kinds of things that they look at that may be important and should be included, but they should also be talking about the fact that what they went out to study in the first place didn't turn out like they expected, and it didn't help sell any of the products.
So here's the doctor in a position to treat a patient, reads an article in a rush, and misses this because it's intentional for the researchers to write it, or the people that write it, to write it up that way.
Exactly.
And then who suffers? The patient.
And the doctors. That's right,
and
because
the
they're frustrated too.
I
mean, a lot of these people who are writing these articles are spinning the results to increase the chances of publishing their articles, as Vicki was saying, in the top journals. And why would they do that? Because it gives them something that will give them more credit. They'll have
notoriety. They'll be hired again.
Sure. And they also bring forward some new information. We don't want to forget that, because at the beginning of a study, that's always the intent. But by the time the study is published and completed, it's not always what happens, because let's face it, to do a study and bring a drug to market can cost $500 million. I mean, you're talking about a lot of money for one drug to come to market.
So there's a lot of pressure to have the results come out the way they want them to.
Well, you can't run a business without money. But there's a line beyond which we don't want to cross, because if we do, what do you think the result will be? What we have today. We'll have these articles that we're bringing forward. And like Marcia Angel, who we mentioned earlier, the Harvard doctor, who was the chief editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, resigned her job, wrote a book, and said that the information coming across her desk was really like a promotion for the pharmaceutical industry and the technology industry, and it wasn't fair. It wasn't honest. It wasn't right.
So it's interesting that they spend these results to increase their chances of being published in these top journals.
Well,
you'd think that the top journals wouldn't want information that wasn't accurate,
well,
that was hidden in the body of it and not in the summary.
The journals make a lot of money. Look at the ads in the journals. They're getting big bucks for that. Sometimes there are more
ads. So there's
ads
a conflict of interest there.
It's huge. And they're a for-profit industry. And they charge doctors, okay, or other people who want to subscribe to those journals a lot of money. And I think that anything that has been published that's been funded by the National Institutes of Health or by the public should be free information, because we've already paid for it. Why don't we have government journals or private journals that are nonprofit that are trying to just get the information out there rather than have the pharmaceutical industry in charge of it?
Exactly.
Because they're paying the money and they're writing the articles and they're throwing it through the journals, and then the journals going ahead and they charge the doctors and people who want to get the information. That's not right.
And then what we talked about recently, about sometimes there's a conflict of interest with the oncologists in giving the chemotherapy to the patients because they're making money off of it.
Making a lot of money off of it.
So, say they read this study and they you know, they believe it.
Yeah.
And so then they start giving it to their patients.
Exactly.
And then they're making a lot of money
off
of it. And then they get themselves deeper and deeper into this whole system.
You get to a place you almost have to lie to yourself to do the things that are promoted by the research industry in the medical journals. And that's why doctors who are oncologists, many of the ones in private practice, for the most part, are making 20 to 30 to 50% of their income off of the sale of pharmaceutical drugs that are used to treat cancer, which is, we don't do that in the other field of medicine. Why should we do it there? And it's very simple. It's because the pharmaceutical industry is not stupid. They know that they can milk as much as they can by raising the price of their drugs to what the market will bear. And if they've got the doctor as their partner, because the doctor is getting half of that profit, that's smart business. So maybe a drug that costs a quarter to make, or $5 to make, or even $100 to make, might be sold for a month's worth for $10,000 or $20,000.
So these doctors are busy. They read these articles and they don't have time, and they look at the abstracts and the tables and everything looks like it's fine, and so they think they're doing something good and they're helping their patients.
Now, a lot of doctors
on the side, they think that they're going to be making some extra money.
That's exactly right.
And so they feel okay about it.
Right.
But they haven't had a chance to read this whole article in detail.
There's not a lot of time. You know, to read one article and really get it, Vicki, take you several hours. You're looking at probably a day to read one article.
Of course, you know that the other side of that is, it isn't that worth it to do that for your patients, particularly if you're going to be giving all, you know, so many of your patients,
yes,
these toxic drugs.
Yes, of course.
To know what goes on with it.
Yes, but it becomes impractical.
Yeah.
How are you going to spend 8 hours a day reading, you know, one article, when you've got to read several articles a week?
Exactly.
I mean, you look at the whole day. And I feel sorry that we don't have medical research that's transparent. And what I mean by that, that puts out the information in a way that's so clear that you don't have to worry about what have they done with the data. Have they manipulated it? You have to get the raw data from a lot of the people, a lot of the articles that are done, and a lot of those places won't release it. So you don't ever really know when you're getting great information that you can believe. That's the problem with the way the medical profession is run. And everybody's kind of bought into it. And so it's the status quo. And all those people that want the status quo to be what it is are going to be happy, because we're going to continue to buy their drugs and do their products and do all the kinds of things that are going to benefit them financially. even the doctors are involved. It's a perfect corrupt system.
Can't the journals get in trouble for publishing this?
They should. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on the health benefits of pine nuts. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, can drinking soft drinks actually lead to depression? And can H. pylori protect against strokes and lung cancer? Stay tuned.
Besides pine nuts in and on our pesto, on salads and on cookies, Dr. Oz recommends eating a shot glass full a day to curb your appetite.
Really?
You know, pine nuts are tree nuts, and they're high in protein and they're heart-healthy fats. And they can decrease the risk of cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes, cancer, even Parkinson's disease. And they can improve cognition. Now, if you eat a jigger of pine nuts 2 hours before any of your main meals, I mean, this will keep you full, so you're likely to eat less at lunch or dinner. And pine nuts are also a good source of calcium and magnesium and potassium and phosphorus and iron and zinc and copper and folic acid.
Okay.
Now, eating them raw and unsalted is the healthiest way, but if you lightly toast them, those can also taste really good on salads.
Yeah, and use a little sea salt if you're going to do that.
And note that old pine nuts smell kind of off and they look oily, so smell them before you buy them and then stare them in an airtight container in the refrigerator.
They get rancid, don't they?
Yeah, right. You don't want to do that. So isn't it interesting that many people tend to be more afraid of extra calories than they are of the possible toxic effects of artificial sweeteners? And when we say artificial sweeteners, we're talking things like aspartame, which is in NutraSweet and Equal, and then artificial sweeteners like Splenda and Sweet and Low and Saccharin and Splenda and so forth. And some of the effects of the artificial sweeteners, ironically, can include weight gain and an increase in appetite, along with an increased incidence of heart attacks and strokes. Now, the latest research suggests adding depression to this list due to a strong association of diet drinks with depression.
Yeah, well, there's a big difference between something that's associated with something and proven to be a cause, because you wouldn't know which way the situation goes. Is it people who are depressed drink more soft drinks, or is it the other way around?
The people who drink them become depressed.
Get more depressed. But the association's clear. This was a study that was done that is going to be presented at the American Academy of Neurology in March of this year. So we're getting an early look at that. And basically, they had 260,000 people between the ages of 50 and 70 that they looked at in 1995 for over a period of a year. And then they looked at how much they had in the way of soda, tea, fruit punch, and coffee. And about 10 years later, they asked these participants whether or not they had been diagnosed with depression in the year 2000. So they had a time to look over what had happened, and they found that about 11,000 of these people had had a diagnosis of depression.
Wow. You know, their suggestion was to replace these with unsweetened coffee, because coffee's tied to a lower risk of depression. But I thought that's kind of an interesting switch, because coffee that's unsweetened isn't going to taste anything like a diet drink.
No. Well, what they found is that people who had more than four sodas a day had 30% more chance of being depressed. And people who had more than four fruit punches a day had a 38% more chance of being depressed. And those that had diet drinks were the ones that were the worst. And coffee showed about a 10% less association with depression.
Well, diet sodas can be addicting. I mean, they can even lead to withdrawal symptoms.
Oh, for sure. And this is something that most people don't realize, that it's so powerful that it can do that. But when we look at functional MRIs after somebody's had a diet soda, it lights up at the pleasure centers of the brain. So it's not a big surprise that there's an association of withdrawal when something is lighting up those centers like that, because that's what leads to withdrawal.
I think people need to know, too, that these diet sodas can be carcinogenic and they can have neurological effects. They can even lead to insomnia and birth defects.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you want to be healthy emotionally and physically, avoid artificial sweeteners.
Oh, they're just not a good idea. I mean, when we look at feeding rats artificial drinks and comparing to those that are drinking sugar, just plain sugar, The rats that are on the diet drinks are getting fatter and more sluggish than the people on the regular just sugar drinks. And it goes beyond that, too, because there have been other studies that have shown an association of diet soda with an increase in heart attack and stroke. And this was in a study that was with 2,500 people followed over 10 years. So this is something that really we have to start getting a little more serious about, and we have to wake up the American Dietetic Association to look at this, because they're recommending artificial sweeteners still instead of using sugar, which I think is obviously both are bad, but I think the artificial sweeteners are worse.
Well, some people think also that when you eat something that's an artificial sweetener, that the cells in your body get all activated and they think, here comes the sugar, here comes the sugar.
Right.
And so then they react as if it were sugar.
And then you have a big shot of insulin coming into play, and that insulin drops the blood sugar level, and of course then it drives you to do what? Eat more, because low blood sugar is one of the most powerful stimulators for the appetite.
Well, we also said we were going to talk about H. pylori. Mm-hmm. H. pylori is also called Helicobacter pylori, also known as the ulcer bacteria.
Right.
And it's been misinterpreted by the medical profession trying to kill it, because it can cause gastric ulcers and stomach cancers, and it can be even associated with diabetes. So while that's not a small issue, the flip side of this is that the most virulent H. pylori species are also associated with the reduction of strokes and lung cancer and asthma and diarrhea and colitis and intestinal infections. So what do we do with this conflicting information when half the world population has H. pylori?
Yeah, see, it's a really good question. When the Australians did this research, I don't know, a decade or two ago, and showed that if you took H. pylori that you wind up inducing ulcers in people, we made the conclusion that the H. pylori was the problem, and that it causes ulcers. And when you find it in people, then the answer was is you should get rid of it. Now, if you have an ulcer, and it's a really bad ulcer, and it's not getting better, using a natural approach to try and make the ulcer heal, then you might be looking at triple therapy, which means a couple of antibiotics and some and using proton pump inhibitors that block all the acid production, and Pepto-Bismol, which is a typical way that we treat those. You're overdoing things, in my opinion, because just because there's an association between the H. pylori and the ulcers and the stomach cancers doesn't mean necessarily that the H. pylori is always a bad thing.
So could we, like, fight this H. pylori by supporting the gut with things like fiber and the pre and the probiotics and some of the other things you talk about frequently, like L-glutamine and DGL? Would those things help to crowd out that H. pylori?
It would, but you'd have to ask yourself the question, in somebody who doesn't have any symptoms, okay, of an ulcer, why would you be thinking about getting rid of the H. pylori? It's because we have this fear that we're going to wind up with an ulcer, okay, or a cancer in our digestive tract, in the stomach area, and that's kind of a frightening thing. But because 50% of the population of the world is carrying H. pylori in them, and I would say 100% actually have H. pylori, but just because you don't grow it out doesn't mean it's not there. We've got thousands of species of microbes in the gut that live in a complex ecosystem that's very important to respect. And there are many ways that the body has of suppressing the overgrowth of certain kinds of microbes that can make us sick. And H. pylori is one of those. Now, everybody's a little bit different. So some people tolerate H. pylori much better than others do. If there's a lot of H. pylori there and it's making metabolic products that can make us sick, much like a Campylobacter infection or Shigella or Salmonella or something like that, that's a different story. So I don't go in there in people who come back with H. pylori in their body and just automatically put them on triple therapy, because I think that's a big mistake. It's only those people that are having trouble.
Well, especially now since we know that that some of the most virulent H. pylori species are associated with the reduction of lung cancer. I mean, that's another kind of – that's like a trade-off.
Well,
the stomach cancer or the lung cancer.
Well, that's right. Well, that tells you more about an association than a cause, because if it was the same in everybody and we had H. pylori, then we'd all have ulcers and we'd all have protection against strokes and lung cancer, which is what this article that was published in the January 2013 issue of the journal called Gut.
So we need a balance here is what I think this is about. And not just having it, but like how much of it's there. And like you were talking about, the balance of the ecosystem, the microflora of that.
Well, we need common sense. And when you talk about probiotics and the ecosystem in the gut, 10 years ago, this was a subject that only a few people in medicine were talking about. It was mostly the doctors who were doing nutritional medicine who had a respect for that. And we've known that for 100 years, that there's a complex ecosystem there that has more metabolic activity than any organ system in the body. It has more. It has 10 times as many microbes in it as it does cells in the body. So the information in the DNA of that whole ecosystem in the gut is bigger than the DNA that's in our cells. So we live in a relationship that's a symbiotic relationship, meaning that we benefit from the bacteria being there, the friendly ones, and they benefit from us because we feed them.
So maybe this H. pylori and the stomach ulcers is an association.
It's not an association.
Okay, so
there.
It is the cause.
In that one, you took the H. pylori, you got an ulcer, okay, and it was a problem.
Okay.
And if you have it a long enough time, a lot of people are going to die from a stomach cancer because the risk is 40 times higher.
Mm-hmm.
But in the other conditions, you don't know that. I wouldn't, for example, if somebody had lung cancer or a stroke or had asthma or had a problem with diarrhea, where we know that higher levels of H. pylori actually protect against those conditions. I mean, isn't that amazing? It protects against those conditions. I wouldn't give them H. pylori bacteria to try and change that for fear that you'd induce an ulcer. So what we have is more information than we know what to do with from the point of view of these funny associations, but not enough information about the actual mechanisms that lead to these illnesses responding to H. pylori or causing H. pylori to either grow or not grow as a marker of disease, much like a PSA is a marker for prostate cancer, but not the cause of it. So we have more research to do.
Well, I thought you just said, though, that H. pylori did cause stomach cancer.
Yes, it does in that case. But these other conditions like stroke, lung cancer, asthma, and some infectious diarrhea is protected.
Yeah.
But, okay, if there's more there. But it's not necessarily the cause of the protection. It may be something that's associated with it for some reason we haven't yet figured out. So what is happening is we're seeing more or less H. pylori in some settings, and we're getting conflicting outcomes. I mean, if it was bad for us, it should make a lot of things bad.
So how do we boost the immunity in our gut for this, for the balance here?
See, now you're talking. That's a smart thing. And that we do with the things you were talking about. We make sure we have a healthy diet. We reduce our stress levels. We get plenty of exercise. We avoid toxic exposures. We don't take a lot of drugs like antibiotics or steroids or birth control pills or things that affect the ecosystem of the gut. We try to stay healthy. If we're healthy, our gut will be healthy. And if it's not, then support it with the things you mentioned, the probiotics, L-glutamine, DGL, quercetin, things like that.
Fiber.
Will support. Fiber, yeah. That's the probiotic. That's right. So, prebiotic.
So if you do have H. pylori, the probiotics can help to crowd it out.
Yeah.
And to establish a balance.
That's because the
fiber. So then you're not taking away from these other things.
That's
like
right.
The lung cancer and.
So basically what's happening is you're talking about feeding fiber, okay, the undigestible residue of the vegetables that we eat that we can't digest, and letting the normal bacteria use them that H. pylori doesn't, and we get better. All right, we're at the end of the show. I'd like to remind you that we're back to talk about what's new in the news in health every Monday morning on PRN.FM and drspooter.com from 10 to 11 Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on drspooter.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, just go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Stay well. We'll see you next time.